You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Dean Ulsher, filling in for Leonard Lopate today. I think my voice is rather hoarse today, and the reason is because I spent the entire night awake finishing a book called Three Little Words, which is a very simple title for a book that portrays in many passages untold horrors. Its author, Ashley Rhodes Corder, went into the foster care system when she was 3.5 years old. Is that right?
That's right.
And then spent 9 years living in 14 different homes. Do I have the numbers right? The numbers
yep,
make an appearance
correct.
Over and over again. 44 caseworkers assigned to you over the years. And then finally adopted at the age of 12.
12 years old.
She tells the story in her memoir. It's called Three Little Words, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. And it is at times not a pretty story, but it does end, I think, pretty happily. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Let's begin at the beginning. You were taken from your mother.
Yes.
Why?
I was initially taken from my mother because her boyfriend had stolen a checkbook, and so they were writing bad checks. And, of course, the files are really kind of all over the place, and there's many, many different versions. But it seems as though initially my mother, you know, maybe just needed a little extra guidance and, you know, maybe just needed to get away from this bad situation with this boyfriend.
At which point you're then taken to grandparents?
No. I was then placed into immediate shelter care.
Right.
And the interesting thing about it was that my mother was obviously released because it wasn't she that was supposed to be arrested. And when she came back to our little apartment, they had padlocked the doors. And so she went to apply for food stamps. And they said, well, you don't apply because your children, or you don't qualify because your children don't live with you. But she couldn't get her children back until she could provide food for us.
Catch 22.
Mm-hmm. She was caught in this catch 22.
How does this foster care system work? People are paid money and get tax breaks, right? If they
Right. Each child in the foster care system essentially is worth a certain amount of money, and foster parents get paid monthly to have these children in their care.
So you then go from place to place over the next years, and you describe some of them fine situations, one absolutely not. I wonder if you could sort of give us a sense of what it was like to live with Mrs. Moss.
Well, the Mosses was a particularly abusive foster home, and we were there with 16 kids in a 1,200-square-foot trailer, and we shared two bedrooms, one bedroom for the girls, one for the boys. And while I was there, we were beaten and starved and locked outside and subjected to a lot of, standing in stressed positions, and we had hot sauce poured down our throats. And it was just a really terrifying few months that I was there.
Our national conversation is now around torture and what constitutes torture. I wonder, when you hear the stories of Abu Ghraib and other places, does that ring true for you?
Well, ironically, many of the stress positions we were subjected to are very similar. We had this the squatting technique that we had to do, and our fingers had to be a certain length off the floor, and a lot of really humiliating abuse. We'd have trash cans put on our heads and we'd be beaten through the trash cans. So it's, very, very similar.
Seems familiar.
Very familiar.
It's not just you we're talking about at this time. It's also your brother, Luke,
mm-hmm.
who's younger than you by how many years?
By 2 or 3 years, depending on the time of year.
Right. And he's a constant presence for you as you're bounced around from place to place, the Mosses being the worst of it. Also during this time, we get periodic visits from your mother, who is not out of the picture.
Correct.
A heartbreaking series of visits, which always disappoints every time you see her. What was going on?
Well, I, as a young girl, I just had so much faith that I was going to be reunited with my mother, and all I wanted to do was be with my mother. And for the longest time, I had so much faith that I would somehow be back with her, and that no matter where she was, she would always come looking for me, and I would, look up at the stars and imagine that she was looking at the same sky and just kind of built this fantasy world. But at the same time, my caseworkers and foster parents weren't really explaining anything to me. So I didn't know that my mother was in jail, that she was getting into trouble. And I think perhaps if I had maybe known that, I wouldn't have built up this whole fantasy and illusion that it was the system, them against us. And so, that was really difficult for me to understand how that relationship was forming.
So even though everybody else understood that you would not be reunited with your mother, even though that may not have been legally certain, you were still holding on to this idea that this was a temporary situation that was going to ultimately lead to your being reunited with her.
I absolutely believed that every move would bring me one step closer to my mother. And even after I was placed with my adoptive family, I saw in a letter that I wrote to my mother that I still had these very strong feelings for her. And in the P.S. I wrote, I don't call these new parents mom and dad. You know, you'll always be the mother in my life. So even here, after I'd been placed in an adoptive family, I still had this feeling and this desire to be with her in some way.
Even through to the very end of the book, there's a side of me that thinks maybe you hold on to a hope even now. Am I right? Or have you
reconciled
with the fact that you're not going to?
Well, now that I'm an adult, I've been able to have a different kind of relationship with her. I am back in touch with her, and she has her life together and as best she can, and has a new daughter. And so I'm proud of her for overcoming her adversities. And now, again, that I'm older, I'm realizing some of the things that she went through and why her life wasn't exactly easy. So it's a different kind of relationship, but my adoptive parents always say that you can never have too many people in your life that care about you. So even though I kind of stay at a distance with the relationship, it's still nice to have that mm-hmm. support.
Getting back to the horrible situation at the Mosses, you're questioned repeatedly about whether you're telling the truth, which is something that comes up a lot in these situations in daycare centers where abuse is alleged. It's a question of your word against theirs. Mm-hmm. And how old are you at this point when you're living at the Mosses?
I must have been about seven years old.
Right.
And I would go to school. I was kind of this loudmouth kid, you know, and that's why I was immediately branded a liar and a troublemaker, because I would go to school and I would tell about my abuse and I would show my bruises. And so teachers and counselors would spark investigations. But when the investigators would come to the home, first of all, they would never question us alone. So here we had the Mosses glaring at us as we're being asked these questions about the abuse.
You were afraid that if you were
absolutely
open,
I was one of the only kids that admitted to what was happening because they were so terrified of what would happen when these people left.
So there's sort of a ring of complicity there. It's not just the fact, though, that there are people, that the Mosses were present during the questioning. There are other things at play as well in terms of people not stepping in and saying, oh, we've got to remove her from the situation. What was it?
Right. Well, there were several caseworkers who knew about the abuse. And later, when I was involved in my lawsuits, I had access to my files. And reading one of my brother's files, there's actually a little memo in his file that says, these abuse records are to be destroyed shortly. And the abuse records have gone missing, but they left the memo in his files indicating that the abuse records were destroyed.
So what interest would a caseworker have in covering up abuse?
It's so much more paperwork for them. You know, if there was a problem here, they're going to have to find this kid another home. They're going to have to do more transporting. I mean, it's, you know, a bit more work. And I had caseworkers who falsified records, would write down fake mileage, would be working other jobs while they were supposed to be visiting their children.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just my experience that I had caseworkers who weren't really following through on their responsibilities.
A lot of bad guys in the story. Again, getting back to the numbers, 73 child welfare administrators, 44 child welfare caseworkers, 19 foster parents, 23 attorneys, and on and on and on, totaling 195 people. You write only Mary Miller, she was your guardian ad litem,
mm-hmm.
and Martha Cook, she was an
attorney ad litem.
Attorney. They were the only two unpaid volunteers, and yet they were the two people who made the greatest difference in your life. They were the angels. Makes me think that money is at the root of this problem.
Money, well, in fact, I think money is a big problem of the child welfare system. It seems as though America is almost in the business of foster care, and agencies lose money when they don't have foster kids, and the funds that the government allows can only be allocated for, you know, foster care. That there's no money available for wraparound services, for rehabilitative services, for biological families. You know, if my biological mother had been given even a fraction of the money they were paying strangers to abuse me, perhaps that would have turned her life around and she could have kept our family together. But unfortunately, there are no such services, and they're very difficult to get that kind of support.
Ashley Rhodes Corder is the author of Three Little Words. It's a memoir published by Simon and Schuster. Is this directed as at a younger audience, this book?
It's published under the young adult division of Simon and Schuster, but I think it's a book for all audiences, and it's not just
I worry about younger audiences reading this book. It's so horrifying.
But you would be amazed at what young people can absorb. And I, you know, even growing up, I was 3 years old taking care of my infant brother, begging for milk. So I don't know. I think young people are experiencing things like this every day. So I don't know that it would be terribly shocking. There are some horrifying aspects, but I think it's something young people can really relate to, as well as adults, to get to see what's going on in the mind of a young person and to show young people that there, you know, really is light at the end of the tunnel.
For you, that happened in the form of another set of saints, the people who ended up adopting you, who got a really raw deal from you for a while.
I was not an easy child. I mean, they were essentially adopting a teenager. So socially, I was being forced to basically relive a childhood and grow up and love and attach. But psychologically, I was wanting to be with my friends and be independent and form my own identity. So it was a really trying time. It was very, very hard. But they were incredibly patient. And they never gave up on me. And I think that's something I would advise to all parents is that just don't give up on your kids.
Right, because the subtext is if you screw up, they'll send you back.
I absolutely, every day I believe that. Well, and interestingly enough, even 2.5 years after the adoption had been finalized, I was having this, you know, mother-daughter chat with my mom about, you know, oh, well, if I did this, you know, the teenager kind of question and answer sort of thing.
And pushing the boundaries, you mean?
Yeah, pushing the boundaries. I was testing them out. And I said, well, if I did, you know, such and such, would you send me back? So here it was, 2.5 years after my adoption had been finalized, I still had this notion that I could be sent back at any time, which, you know, really broke my mom's heart. And she just didn't understand that. And she said, Ashley, you know, we have nowhere to send our biological sons, and you're no different.
Right. There's a lot of reassurance from them about how much they love you and how much they want you. And still, in spite of that, in spite of the fact that they are living in pretty terrific circumstances, especially given what you had been through before,
right.
Still you pushed the boundaries. What was the psychology at play there that forced you to threaten this pretty good situation?
Well, I had I believe I still have a bit of an attachment disorder. I had been rejected my entire life. I certainly had no faith that these people were going to keep me. I had no faith that they were going to love me. And I just thought that essentially it was all too good to be true. There had to be something wrong. I was just very skeptical and cynical. And the more I pushed, the more they, you know, came out on top and stuck with it. And finally, you know, I did something that was so bad that I thought, oh boy, this is it. I'm going back for sure. But
you basically poisoned them.
Well, I did. A girlfriend of mine convinced me to sneak out of the house to meet some boys, and I crushed up some ibuprofen and put it in their drinks, thinking that, oh, if they don't have a headache, they're going to sleep really well tonight. So, you know, it was just silly teen stuff, but I did this, and they freaked, you know, they were really worried. They thought, my God, this kid has just poisoned us, and they're banging on my door. How long do we have to live, Ashley? And, you know, I thought, oh boy, I'm done for. But they stuck it out, and that was just unbelievable to me. And that was kind of when my walls broke down, and I realized, well, geez, if these people are going to stick through this, there's no way I'm going anywhere.
Then with the help of your adopted mother, you go and conduct an investigation of your own, which you're counseled not to do. They say, this is not a headache that you want to take on, and yet you insist. You go back and you find all of the necessary documents regarding the Mosses and your case to file a suit.
Right. I think both of my adoptive parents were incredibly, they encouraged me quite a bit to find out about my past, and especially my mother wanted to know, you know, things mothers want to know, like medical records and, you know, different habits that I had. But they, in terms of a lawsuit, when I was a teenager, I saw the movie Erin Brockovich. And so I was like, well, hey, I want one of those class action thingies. I want to do that. And my parents were like, you know, Ash, do you really understand what that means? And it's going to be your word against theirs, and it's going to be really painful. Let's just deal with this in therapy. But after they consulted an attorney, they said, you know, she said to my mom, you know, you're a great mom, but you're a terrible attorney. You know, this, you know, really could be something. And so both of my parents finally agreed. They said, okay, Ash, you can have your lawsuits. Just don't you dare dress like Julia Roberts. And so the lawsuits began, and I think eventually they were all settled. But the most beautiful part was that the Moss home was closed.
There was also a criminal investigation at the same
time. Oh, yes. I had three lawsuits, but I was able to get the other children in the Moss home suits of their own, as well as my brother. So that was just a really, you know, wonderful, wonderful situation.
What was the final charge that led to them being
put out of business? Ultimately, they were arrested with over 30 counts of felony child abuse with torture. And from that, they were put in jail, and all of their children were removed. And I had three settlements, and you know, I think there's ongoing cases today. The cases are still going on.
You've become an activist. You want to reform the system, which you portray as pretty entrenched, and the idea that you could make a difference seems unlikely given the picture that you paint. What do you hope to do?
I hope to, well, and the reason I wrote the story, I didn't want it to be a sob story. I didn't want people to feel sorry for me. I talked about some of the horrors because I need to, I feel like, establish credibility with young people and really let people know where I came from. But to me, it's not enough to complain about something if you're not going to provide solutions. So I hope to be a vehicle for communication amongst the states to tell people what programs are working, what programs aren't working, how can we make permanency an objective, how can we find children families more quickly. And I think also educating the American public about what's really happening in our own backyards is something that's very important, because I went to a private college, and it was just shocking to me how many of my peers and even some of my professors who really had no clue what foster care and adoption was all about. So I think just raising public awareness won't be a huge milestone in making change.
What happened to your brother Luke? You were separated from him a long time ago.
He was ultimately adopted, and but because of the, I mean, he was just permanently damaged by everything that happened to him while we were in foster care. So he's going to have many struggles throughout his adult life. And so he's kind of a personal and constant reminder of why I need to continue to do what I'm doing and continue to try to make change.
You're in school now?
I actually just graduated in December.
All right.
And
so what will you be doing?
Well, right now I'm working on
book tour,
and I'm also doing a lot of speeches around the country. I'm talking to everyone from child welfare groups to, you know, people making the laws and young people, and I'm just, I don't know, running around the country getting the word out.
Movies played a big role in, first of all, deciding to file a suit with Erin Brockovich. Also, The Cider House Rules was part of your worldview. I wonder if you've seen this new movie, Gone Baby Gone.
You know, I haven't seen it, no.
Well, it has a lot to do with your story, and it has a big plot twist, and I don't want to ruin it for everybody. But all I can say is I liked it, and I hope you'll see it too, and then we can come back and talk about it some more after you've seen it.
That'd be wonderful.
Ashley Rhodes Corder is the author of Three Little Words. I want to thank you so much for being here and telling us your story. Again, it's Three Little Words, and it's just out now from Simon & Schuster.
Thank you.